Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. As a continuation of our collaboration with the United Nations Food Systems Summit, today for episode 3 of our mini-series, Laying Down Tracks, we'll be discussing nature-based production. Joining me as co-host for this episode is the chairman of the summit's Action Track number 3, Joao Campari of the World Wildlife Fund. Welcome, Joao. How you doing?
Just fine, Aaron. Delighted to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure. Joining from Brazil, hey, how are things in Brazil? You doing all right? You staying healthy and positive?
Very well, very well. Healthy and positive. And in a semi-lockdown here. So all's well. Thank you.
Yeah, I think, what we've all taken out of that is, I guess there's something that a disruption of a global pandemic can teach us is just how important the production of our food really is. I think that goes across the board. We realize how essential our producers are and the folks that bring that food to market. And I think that's been a collective across the globe. I know in your role of the global leader of the WWF's food practice, you're focused on enhancing the sustainability of the global food system. But when we talk about nature-positive food production, what do we mean?
Oh, Aaron, this is a really good question, and thanks for asking. And let me start by saying that for food systems to be considered nature-positive, three things must happen at once, right? First, we need to protect nature from further conversions for food and feed production. Like, we need to choose not to deforest, not to convert savannas and grasslands or polluting waters. So we need to freeze first the footprint of food and feed production for a system to begin to become nature positive. But this is not sufficient. So we need to move to a second level. And the second level is that we need to do a much better job at managing our working lands and working waters. These are the places that produce food today. Like, we need to begin to adopt more regenerative practices that can help combat climate change, for example, or promote or scale out agroecological approaches alongside other production technologies that respect the ability of the planet to regenerate itself. We call these planetary boundaries. And several planetary boundaries, as you know, are being trespassed today, which is putting us in a danger zone, which we call planetary emergency. But the third component of nature positive, and to truly make the food system nature positive, we need to restore degraded places, rehabilitate degraded soils, for example, and bring all this back to life. There are approximately, Aaron, 2 billion hectares of degraded and degrading lands in the world. This is about the size of South America, just to give you an idea. So it strikes me that some of it can be recovered, can be brought to life to produce food sustainably or to deliver more ecosystem services or both. So in a nutshell, the goal of nature-positive food systems is to globally meet the fundamental human right to healthy and nutritious food within planetary boundaries, of course.
Thank you for that very concise and elegant description. I think that is something that those three pillars will be essential that we'll come back to here. Before we jump into the conversation, I want to just read your bio so our listening audience has a bit more of your background. Campari's primary area of focus are sustainable agriculture and aquaculture, sustainable diets, and food loss and waste. Prior to joining the WWF, Joao was the Special Sustainability Advisor to the Ministry of Agriculture in Brazil, where he served as the President of the Low Carbon Agricultural Platform and as Executive Secretary of the Agribusiness Commission on Sustainable Development. Campari holds a PhD in Environmental Economics, and his research and publications focus on the nexus of rural poverty and natural resource management in agricultural frontiers. So thanks again for joining. One thing I want to get just before we can, because I think this is key to your key pillars that you're talking about of protecting nature, managing the working lands and waters that we have now and restoring, is a statistic that's often dropped about when we talk about food requirements for feeding 9 billion by 2050. is that we talk about the, we're going to need the equivalent of another Brazil for that production. So, Joel, can we feed the growing population with current production practices on the current land? Because to my knowledge, we're not printing anymore, right? So how do we, is it three pillars that we move forward with, or how do we move forward for 2050?
We have to. In fact, we already have converted, and we have already enough land out there to produce food. The problem, Aaron, is that a lot of the food that we are producing is wasted, right? I mean, so 30% of all food that gets produced is never eaten. So, you know, can you imagine the power of reallocating this food for those who are currently excluded from the food system, which is like about 99% of the global population suffer from chronic hunger. And while we waste one third and lose one third of our food. So, you know, it's not only about thinking about whether land is sufficient or not. We need to address the systemic issues in the system. And if you look, I mean, you know, the way that we have been producing food right now has caused 80% of the deforestation. It's driven biodiversity loss by 70% on land and 50% on freshwater. Yet 52% of existing farmland is degraded due to unsustainable practices. So what we are doing right now with our natural resources and with the lands that have been converted to agriculture is not, you know, it's not a pretty picture. But at the same time, look, we cannot vilify the food system, right? I mean, it's serving the purpose of feeding more than 7 billion people, you know. So we need to rethink, I believe, the way that we need to rethink the food system. We need to refocus you know, this system towards more right-based approaches to deliver the sustainable development goals, for example. We need to redesign policy and the enabling conditions for systemic transformations to enable farmers and fishers everywhere, you know, to produce food sustainably. Repurpose financial flows is another aspect that, you know, we need, the food system is a public good. We need to repurpose financial flows to serve this public good. And also, I mean, become practical to resolve aspects of the systems. For example, we are 9 years away from delivering the SDGs. If you are a farmer or a fisher, this means that you have 9 harvests to deliver the sustainable development goals. This is not much at all. We need this sense of urgency. We need to mobilize the world, you know, and every stakeholder to make this transition happen.
9 harvests. That's, yeah, time is pressing us. And as you said, if we're living within these planetary boundaries, we got some work to do. But hey, let's jump from land to sea and welcome our guest today. So joining for episode 3 of Laying Down Tracks is the United Nations Special Envoy for the Oceans, Peter Thompson. Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Not too bad, thanks.
Calling in from London via Fiji, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I've been here for the lockdown.
Okay, so well, it's we're all taking new things out of this, and I think that's encouraging when we can come out of this and have a new perspective around that those 9 harvests and those planetary boundaries. Hey, Peter, in a briefing that I saw that you gave to the financial industry, you explained that we cannot have a healthy planet without a healthy ocean, and in any global discussion on biodiversity, the ocean must be front and center. But mankind seemingly has been a bad shepherd of the bounty of the sea, a bit of our tragedy of the commons. If you would, please tell us a bit about your work in protecting the oceans and how we can move forward here.
Yeah, that mantra that I use of no healthy planet without a healthy ocean, the important rider on that is that we are currently observing an ocean with declining health. And that's measurable by, you know, the fact that we have 30% overfishing the ocean. It's measurable by the millions of tons of plastic that we're dumping in the ocean. It's measurable by the rate of acidification of the ocean and the deoxygenation of the ocean and the warming of the ocean. The latter three all caused, of course, by our greenhouse gas emissions. And so these are all accelerating trends which are observable through science. Nobody's making this up. This is scientifically proven around the world that we have a declining health of the ocean. So this is very serious for us when you think that, you know, the ocean has the great majority of life. It's hosted in the ocean. The fact that, you know, half the oxygen on the planet is produced in the ocean. So this is very serious stuff. Everybody has to be part of reversing that cycle of decline in which the ocean is caught.
Joel, I'll encourage you to jump in with any questions you have. I don't want to monopolize here in any way, but I have a laundry list of things based off what Peter shared.
Peter, when we think about oceans, we always hear many things, many threats, right? Including some of them that trespass the planetary boundaries, as I was talking before. So we have overfishing, we have loss of habitat, we have plastics, chemical pollution, increasingly the compounding effect, all of these increase the compounding effect of climate change. Given that so many people out there in the developing world mainly are dependent on the ocean for food and jobs, what do you think are some of the most practical pathways to sustainability in the ocean?
Okay, well, I think the first thing that we have to address, and, you know, we have to be honest about this, is the greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. You know, if we allow them to continue on their current path, you know, we're heading to over 3 degrees global warming by the end of this century when our grandchildren will still be alive, and that's a world on fire. So whether you live on the land, as the majority of us do, or whether you're dealing with the ocean, as my daily work is involved, you know, that's a terrible path to be on. And obviously, we refuse that future for our grandchildren. So what can we do about it? And that's, I guess, where your question is going. Well, first of all, the greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, we can talk about ocean acidification if you're interested. But, you know, that's one of the effects of the greenhouse gas emissions, as I mentioned. We can talk about the loss of oxygen. That's another effect of those greenhouse gas emissions. But ocean warming, I think, you know, your listeners all understand that leads to, you know, the death of coral reefs. Mm-hmm. Coral reefs are essential for the health of the ocean. They're the bunkers of biodiversity of the ocean. They will all be gone at 2 degrees. We're currently heading to 3 degrees, okay? And of course, warming sea levels, warming ocean also gives rise to rising sea levels, and you all know what's happening there. So, You have those, but as I mentioned earlier, it's also the pollution, especially the plastic, but also the industrial and agricultural waste going into the ocean, and there is the overfishing. So these are all things that we can turn around. You know, it's not an impossibility. It's something that with better management, and that goes, management, of course, goes from multilateral level of the United Nations down to governments, down to regional groups, down to companies, down to individuals. You know, what are we personally able to do to improve things? Maybe using less plastic, recycling better, maybe only eating sustainable fish and refusing to eat illegally caught fish, for example, and doing what we can to get the greenhouse gas emissions down. Do you still drive an internal combustion engine car, for example? Do you still eat beef, for example? You know, these are things which all of us have some power, and we all have to act as if we make a difference, because we do.
Mm-hmm. Peter, if I may jump with another question about, you know, what is legal, what is illegal. I mean, this relies mostly on assigning property rights, for example, and in such a vast area where property rights are so imperfectly enforced, like in the oceans, unlike it could be in land. How important are well-designed and well-managed networks of protected areas for securing fisheries and hence food sustainability from the oceans?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll come to MPAs because, of course, the essential point there is, are they being properly governed mm-hmm. and enforced? But you have to appreciate, as I'm sure you do, and many others listening do, that there's a lot of crime out there in the ocean. You know, it's an area that is very hard to police. We have, when I say we, humanity, through the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, has mm-hmm. divided up the ocean into the high seas and the exclusive economic zones. So the exclusive economic zones are along the coastlines of coastal countries where they have 200-mile exclusive economic zones. And those are their rights under law now, but they're also a responsibility to properly manage what's going on in there. And we're obviously calling for more marine protected areas in those exclusive economic zones, but it's also required on the high seas. Your question was specifically about marine protected areas, MPAs.
Yeah.
And it is shown that if they are properly enforced, that in the matter of a few years, they quickly resume their former biodiversity and begin replenishing the marine resources outside of their boundaries. So fishermen actually benefit from having marine protected areas in their neighborhoods. And we want to take that concept, when I say we, over 70 countries have agreed to this now, for there to be 30% of the world's ocean to be in properly governed marine protected areas by 2030.
Regarding that, and properly protected, I mean, I one thing that always strikes me is the fact that we've treated the oceans as kind of never land for so long, right? They're the dumping grounds for so many things. And I do want to come back to the impact, how it comes full circle to us and catches and fisheries. But specifically, you know, it draws to me the famous saying that Mahatma Gandhi says, which is waste is only a resource in the wrong place. So are we finding, or have you seen, that sewage and fluid waste and contaminants and plastic waste, and getting ahead of it before it even reaches the oceans, are you seeing signs of light that we're going to be able to address this problem within the next decade and really start to address some of those protected areas through reducing the volume of gross contaminants we're putting in there?
I throw this to Zhao as well, because he's more terrestrial than I am.
But, sure.
The ethos that your listeners should understand is the source to sea ethos. And there's a lot of work being done on that all around the world. Others call it ridge to reef. You know, I come from Fiji, and it's very, for a young boy sitting on the seawall, it was very easy to see the source to sea ethos in action each day. You know, the precipitation rises up off the sea in the morning as the sun starts shining, goes into the clouds, the cloud drifts across the harbor, it hits the mountain, precipitation, down it comes, and out to the harbor and out to the sea again. You could see that hydrologic cycle happening every day. Now, of course, the problem is, what happens between when the rain hits the mountain and when the river takes the water back into the harbor? It's picking up pollutants along the way, pollutants that didn't used to be there, you know, like fertilizer, like industrial waste, like the plastic that's coming off the streets and so on. Mm. So that's the problem. And are we addressing that seriously enough? Look, the problem is so vast now. If you go to Southeast Asia and look at those plastic-choked rivers, you see the vastness of this problem. But are we doing something about it? Yes. I think there is now, because of the awareness that's there, people are starting to realize that, okay, we've got to invest heavily into plastic waste collection systems on land, better recycling systems, etc. So, but Zhao, I throw it to you because this is also a land problem.
No, thanks. Thanks for that. And thanks for the question. I mean, you know, we have seen, especially, let me bring back to the Food Systems Summit now. And Action Track 3, which is our core remit in the summit, is to boost nature-positive food production systems at scale. And part of nature-positive, I mentioned briefly in my initial remarks, is to begin to adopt regenerative practices on land and in water. And one big idea that is emerging in Action Track and from multiple organizations as we source these game-changing solutions is agroecology. And there is one particular idea that has emerged, is like how we can scale out agroecological principles and agroecological approaches to resolve in great part, Peter and Aaron, what you have been describing. So we need to understand this better. We need to scale out these practices and principles and make some of them or all of them part of mainstream agriculture. We need to rethink the whole system. And it's only by rethinking the system, how food is produced on land, that we can resolve a big part of the problems that oceans face today.
Hmm. Yeah, if I could jump in there, Joel, because what you say really resonates on what we need to do in the ocean as well. You mentioned the wastage that occurs on in food production on land. That's exactly the same from the sea. That's 30% of the wastage when it comes to fish catch. But you know, how do you take that ecological approach to marine food production? And here you're looking at new forms of aquaculture. You know, wild catch is this is the last form of mankind going out and hunting with a spear every day. You know, it doesn't have a big future, wild catch. In fact, it's been plateaued for decades. The future lies in aquaculture. But it's like, what is ecologically acceptable in aquaculture? That's what we've got to transform ourselves into, because we can really feed the world with all the protein it needs from the sea. But we've got to be farming appropriate species, you know, not top of the food chain stuff, appropriate species. They've got to have appropriate feed. You know, they're not being fed on other fishes. They're being fed on plant matter or insect matter and so on. And they've got to be in appropriate ecological settings. So very much, you know, the same kind of thinking that you're applying terrestrially is what we have to apply in the ocean.
And Peter, if we can discuss about aquaculture, because aquaculture is super controversial too. I mean, and you know, what do we have to get right from your perspective to ensure aquaculture can deliver, you know, quote unquote blue food on the scale and with the urgency that we need?
Yeah, well, you know, when people think of aquaculture, I think they sort of think of salmon in fjord-like situations being fed on antibiotics and covered in sea lice and all the rest. And we've all seen those programs. But sort of aquaculture I'm talking about here, and, you know, which the world is increasingly talking about, is things like non-fed aquaculture. Which has very low environmental impact. In fact, it has environmental benefits. If you think of shellfish eating nutrients, excess nutrients coming down rivers and filtering them. But it's things like, yes, the non-fed aquaculture world is shellfish, you know, mussels, oysters, and is seaweed, you know, which is the great resource of the future in terms of blue foods. The benefits of us multiplying seaweed production, kelp and other forms of algae, is just immense, whether it's climate change or nutrition or feeding animals or fertilizers or medicines. It's all there. So that is one very positive thing for the future, is seaweed production. And now, Jean, I've forgotten what your question was in the first place. I've talked so much.
No, you've responded. You've responded, Peter. Thank you so much. Actually, he responded too because I had one about the future of seaweed, and you just answered that. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, okay. those are key things, and I love this idea of this bridging of terrestrial production into ocean farming, and the idea that regenerative ocean farming is a realistic thing now. I mean, it's the best description I've heard of regeneration, right? And regenerative agriculture is everything is renewed in the process of using it, right? And so we invest in ecological systems, which then spawn out this nourishment. And it's the investing in the system as a whole, which ultimately is doing that. And I think, Peter, to your point, and as I mentioned, I come from New England, which is a bit of a capital when it comes to shellfish production and that type of keystone species, and investing in those ecological systems in shellfish and seaweed production also develops the hatcheries and the fishery programs for larger groundfish too. And so, you know, the net positive, the net benefit of this is essential. Peter, I want to jump onto that too. Actually, ask one question related to that is, you know, there's kind of a, I don't want to create a line of demarcation around ocean health of us dealing with our contaminants and then looking at what we then take out of the ocean, which is, you know, our seafood, our sustenance. And I think the stat shows there's still like 3 billion people are relying on seafood for this. To your point of view, do we need seafood as this conduit to the oceans? It's 70% of the earth covering, you know, this is the surface level is mostly blue. Is it seafood that connects us to this? And how do we leverage that if it is?
Our connection with the ocean is everything, really. I mean, if you're talking long term, we were produced by the ocean. No, it's not just fish and food. You know, the ocean, the sustainable blue economy is about many things. First of all, it's about reestablishing a relationship of respect and balance with the ocean and making sure that our interaction with it is sustainable, right, in the true sense of the word. Eating fish is only one part of that. You have to think about the fact that offshore energy, you know, wind in particular, it can give us all the energy we need. That's been shown very clearly by the appropriate UN agencies. You have to look at the fact that we're on the cusp of a revolution in powering our shipping. You know, 90% of trade is carried by ships. They burn the dirtiest form of greenhouse gas and producing bunker fuel, and that's got to stop. You know, and we're on the cusp of that transformation because we know that green hydrogen can provide us that, plus other innovations like sail and so on. And we know that sustainable agriculture, the sort of thing we've just been discussing, can feed us. We know that our medicines are going to come from the ocean in the post-antibiotic age. So the relationship with the ocean is, it's like a relationship with our mother, really. It's something that, you know, where maybe we've, you know, mistreated her since all that love that she gave us and after bringing us up. But we're going to get back now into a good relationship with respect and balance.
If I may jump
in. Sorry, you mentioned that you're from the northeast of the United States. I'm very aware that, you know, some of these fisheries that you're talking about, of course, have been maltreated by humanity and overfished. I mean, the cod experience of Northeast America, of course, is one of the great historical examples. And we're seeing the same thing happening to bluefin tuna now in the North Pacific. So, yeah, you know, that's why I say we've got to respect nature. We can't just go out there and sort of shoot all the elephants and expect the elephants to come back next year or something. So that doesn't happen that way. So that's where the respect word comes in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as we fish down the commons, right? I mean, yeah, from New Bedford here as being the heyday of the whaling industry. And then to your point of the cod flood that happened after that. And we just keep moving down the trophic level here until we're going to exhaust the sea because of greed and hubris maybe. But I think it's these types of conversations, this type of engagement, this awakening happening across the board. I'm encouraged, at least next generation. I see people in their teens and 20s and 30s that live this, they breathe this. They're so enthusiastic. I mean, this is the mission in their life to come to this. And actually, Joelle, what I see too is this awakening towards soil health, people's appreciation of carbon sequestration and regeneration of land. Have you seen that in Brazil and some of your work with the WWF?
Well, yes, this is a really interesting area. And regenerative agriculture, when we mention regenerative agriculture, the basis for it is to enhance carbon sequestration in the soil. In Brazil, actually, there is there's a program. It's called the Low Carbon Agriculture Plan, in which you farm in a different way. You put you do like crop rotation, you do crops and animals in the same property. You plant trees in the same property. It's a very, very interesting approach. You use the same productive unit or a farm for different purposes. You know, so you sequester carbon, you provide food, you produce more varieties of food and so on. So it's really, really interesting. So regenerative agriculture is a big part of the Food System Summit. And we have a wonderful team leading what we're calling developing a soils hub for food security and nutrition. So this is an emerging area in the Food System Summit, which promises to deliver, whose value propositions would deliver value to many, many different parts of the food system. But if I may, you know, I am just, I'm as much as an economist as I am an environmentalist. And I would like to pick up a point that you and Peter have mentioned, which is our relationship with nature and going back to oceans. When I think of fish in the wild, I think of biodiversity, right? I don't think immediately as fish in the wild as food. So this is why I think aquaculture is very important when well done. So what are the things, Aaron and Peter, that you have either through these podcasts, Aaron or Peter, in your experience, what are the mistakes or the things that have happened on land management that must be avoided when we think of oceans as a source of food?
Well, that's a great question. And yeah, I do have an example. But first of all, think of clearing a forest and, you know, what that does to our carbon situation. Well, the same thing has been going on in the ocean, because seagrass meadows, mangroves, kelp forests, we have wiped out 50% of them and are continuing to do so. So that's got to be turned around. Why? They sequester actually 4 times the amount of carbon that their terrestrial cousins do, you know, trees. And so they're really important to our future. And then I want to just tell you about something that I read a couple of weeks ago in Nature magazine. Now, Nature, of course, you know, you've got to be peer-reviewed before you get an article in there. And this was an article by 26 prominent marine scientists and economists, led by Enric Sala from National Geographic. And in this paper, there were a few things in it, but the one that really struck me is that bottom trawling, and you know what bottom trawling is? This is fishing boats basically dragging chains across the ocean, like plowing the fields on land, really, I suppose. There's always been a problem with that from an ecological point of view, but it's been justified because of the very effective method this is to catch fish, you know, because the chains are attached to huge nets. But they have shown in this paper, and believe me, this really blew my mind, that there is more CO2 released from bottom trawling than the whole of the world's civil aviation industry. And think about that. And then the other very important thing for me, because I then went and looked up, okay, who are the main bottom trawlers around the world? What countries? And it's no coincidence that they're the same countries that are the biggest emitters of CO2 on land.
So, Peter, how can we, you know, going back analogous questions that Aaron asked about soils, how can we restore ocean health to support nature-positive food production from the restoration perspective?
Well, firstly, and I can't join with people that say we should not catch any more fish. Why? Because, you know, there's billions of people out there relying on that, especially in developing countries. But, hey, the developed countries eat most of the fish anyway. You know, that's just not a feasible option. That's why I say the aquaculture development is so important, sustainable aquaculture. Secondly, the fish that we do catch from the wild has to be caught in very much better managed ways. There's 30%, over 30% overfishing going on at the moment. That's an FAO statistic. And I'm sorry, but, you know, if you're overfishing by 30%, it shows you're not managing properly. And so we know where the problems are. They're in the what they call the RFMOs, the Regional Fisheries Management Organizations. We know which ones they are, and we want to get alongside them and help them to have better management practices so that this overfishing does not occur. That's the second point. And then, you know, I think the third point is, you know, diverse away from the idea that we have to eat flesh. You know, more plant-based diets are the order on land, and also the order on sea. And that's where the seaweed and other forms of non-flesh life from the ocean are great food sources for the future.
Let me do this. Peter, I'm going to read a bit more about your background, then I have a more of a broader ethereal question tied to that. So in 2007, the United Nations Secretary General Guterres appointed Ambassador Peter Thompson of Fiji as the special envoy to the oceans, aiming at galvanizing concerted efforts as a follow-up to the outcomes of the 2017 United Nations Ocean Conference. Your goals, as I understand them, are to maintain the momentum for actions that conserve and sustainably use the oceans, seas, and marine resources for sustainable development. Since being appointed, you've led the UN's advocacy and public outreach efforts inside and outside the UN system, ensuring that many positive outcomes of the 2017 Ocean Conference, including over 1,500 voluntary commitments, are analyzed and implemented. I read that your work is with civil society, with scientific communities, with the public sector, and other relevant stakeholders that coalesce and encourage mindful activities in support of the implementation of Sustainable Development Goal 14. Peter was the president of the 71st session of the UN General Assembly, during which he provided the visionary leadership and guiding of all important preparation for that 2017 Ocean Conference. Peter, if you would, maybe you could share with our audience some of those experiences you've had since taking the helm 4 years ago. Maybe an anecdotal story. Maybe put on your best politician hat and tell us some interesting stories about getting out and meeting people in these marine communities, in these environments, the fishermen, the folks affected by this. And I'd love to hear some of that.
Well, thanks for reminding me of that background. I sometimes forget it. As I mentioned, I come from Fiji, and my background is really in rural development. Started off after university, basically putting in village water supplies and sewage, low-key sewage things. And that's my background. How I ended up as president of the United Nations, I have no idea, but it happened. And as a result of being the Fiji permanent representative at the UN from 2010 through to 2017, I was part of that SDG formation, SDG negotiations, you know. And one thing that was very clear was the ocean was not on people's radar. You know, people were very rightly concerned about, you know, poverty on land and food production on land and so on, but the ocean just wasn't there. But those of us that came from small island developing states like Fiji, we could see what was going on, that, you know, the fish stocks were going down, the reefs were dying, the pollution was mounting on our tide lines, all that, right? So that's why we fought to have SDG 14 there. SDG 14, for your listeners, is to conserve and sustainably use the ocean's resources. That's its aim. It's got 10 targets. So having got that into the Sustainable Development Goals, we then said, well, you know, how are we going to keep this honest? And so I had the opportunity when I was president of the General Assembly to put together the Ocean Conference, which Fiji and Sweden co-hosted in New York at the United Nations. And that was really the awakening, I think, for ocean action around the world. Everybody was invited to come, and they all came. And since then, we've seen ocean action flourishing around the world. So the next UN Ocean Conference is going to be held in Lisbon next year. And the idea there is to move from awareness to actual scientific innovation and business innovation and partnerships, you know, getting people moving on this stuff. So that's where we're going. Look, I could tell you 100 stories about some of the strange things that have happened to me on that journey, but none of them jump to mind at the moment, other than the fact that, you know, when you're dealing with people that have the ocean either at their doorstep or they sail on it every day as fishermen or sailors, you know, the realization is there that we have this responsibility to be much more respectful. I think everybody understands that who has a relationship with the ocean. So that's the main thing I'd like to get across to your viewers.
No,
to your listeners, sorry.
That's fantastic. And I think what we got out of that was the human interest story of your background and the humble perspective. I appreciate that very much. You never expect to be the head of the UN General, the General Assembly. That's incredible. And congratulations on that. And thanks for your incredible work in leading this vision forward, because ultimately, to your point, that is an essential next step. So just to complete that, the point on Lisbon's, you know, your conference next year in Lisbon, obviously we're hoping it's going to be on site, it's going to be in person, and it is around the multi-stakeholder engagement initiatives. It's bringing action to bear. So, you know, what else can we expect to see coming out of that that engagement?
Well, it's the conference is being co-hosted by Kenya and Portugal, who are, you know, putting a huge amount of effort into this, and I work with them on that. But I'm very hopeful it'll be another game changer for the world. We don't see ourselves in a silo, let me say. You know, I work closely with Agnes Kalibata, who's a special envoy for the Food System Summit. I work closely with the CBD Biodiversity Secretariat, who are responsible for the UN Biodiversity Summit that's coming up, and with Patricia Espinosa, who runs the UNFCCC about the Glasgow COP. These things are all part of the same problem, which I mentioned to you earlier, which is that we're heading to a 3-degree world at the moment. And so, you know, in terms of where do we go from here, you know, I say as a loving grandfather that there is no surrender on this. You know, you can't just expect other people to do this for you. We're in a battle for the lives of our grandchildren, because 3 degrees is a world on fire, and we cannot accept that future, as I said at the start of this discussion.
Joel,
Peter, Aaron, if I may, you know, when we were talking about the Oceans Summit, and I kept thinking, I mean, you know, we are, if you look from now, in a year ahead of us, we have so many important moments for us to synergize. There is the Food Summit, there is the Climate Summit, Biodiversity COPs, and the Oceans Summit. We need to make, and we are already doing, but we need to make more effort to connect all of this, to create a meta-narrative that connects all these parts, and to think about these four summits, food, climate, biodiversity, and oceans, as a unified system of delivering change, you know, that reconnects people with nature, that reconnects the food systems as a source of life, that connects biodiversity, you know, and climate. I mean, we are facing a triple challenge of food insecurity, of biodiversity loss, and climate change. And I think oceans offer such an opportunity to help resolve or readdress all of this. We need to create a unified vision across all these summits and put together a clear roadmap to deliver the SDGs in the 9 years we have left to deliver them. So,
wise words, Zhao. I couldn't have put it better myself, and I 100% agree with you.
Well, I can't thank you both enough for taking the time to share such wisdom. I learned a great deal, and I know our listeners well as well. So, Peter, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. And to your listeners, don't imagine somebody else is going to do this for you. We're all in this together. And, you know, please sit down with your families tonight and work out, you know, what you can do, because I've done it with my family, and work out what you can do to get us to a net zero carbon world by 2050. That's the goal. That's what will keep us at around about 1.5 degrees global warming, which we can live with. So everybody, we're all in this together. Let's make it happen.
Great insights.
Peter, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Peter, for being here with us, and Aaron for giving me the opportunity to co-host this conversation with you. Thanks,
all. Joel, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. And until next time, thanks again.